From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. From PACs to super PACs, big money and dark money, the world of campaign finance has become ever more complex. And since the Supreme Court's 2010 Citizens United decision, spending has soared. New Hampshire is no exception to this trend, with record-breaking spending in our 2012 gubernatorial race and the 2014 U.S. Senate race shaping up to be perhaps the most expensive ever. Given these massive dollar levels, there are many aspects of campaign finance that routinely raise eyebrows, but some say that the system is set up fairly and that all sides can take part equally in exercising their right to free speech in the political arena. Today in The Exchange, we're following the money in New Hampshire's 2014 elections, and let's hear from you. Do you look at campaign funding when deciding who to vote for? How well do you think our current campaign finance system works? And how much does it need fixing? Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have three guests joining me in studio. Is Brian Walston, digital reporter for NHPR. He's been covering campaign funding in the New Hampshire races this year. Brian, good to see you. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Laura.
Also with us from D.C., Russ Choma, money and politics reporter for the Center for Responsive Politics. In that role, he writes for the Open Secrets blog. Formerly, Russ spent 5 years as a newspaper reporter here in the Granite State. And Russ, welcome back to New Hampshire by phone line anyway.
Thanks, Laura. Thanks for having me.
And also with us, Dante Scala, associate professor in the Department of Political Science at UNH. He's also a fellow at UNH's Carsey School of Public Policy. And Dante, welcome back. Good to have you.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, Dante, I want to start with you. Just back to basics, if you could, please. A lot of people hear about the 2010 Citizens United decision at the U.S. Supreme Court and what a game changer that was for campaign finance. How big a deal was it, Dante?
It was certainly very important. The Citizens United case in 2010, the holding there by the majority of the Supreme Court was that the First Amendment prohibited the government from restricting independent expenditures, and that's the key term, independent expenditures, by corporations and unions. Okay, so before Citizens United, corporations and unions can't make independent expenditures. After Citizens United, that's okay, even though the federal ban on direct contributions from a corporation to a candidate and unions as well is still in place. So the key thing there is independent expenditures, expenditures made outside of the candidate's campaign.
So let me just make sure I'm crystal clear on this, Dante. After Citizens United, I could give money. There were still limits on what money I could give directly to candidate Joe Jones. But if I wanted to take out ads and do mailers and TV and so forth in favor of Joe Jones, no limits there.
That's exactly right. There was a second case that a little less famous called SpeechNow.org versus the Federal Election Commission that basically following Citizens United authorized the creation of the so-called super PAC. So now, as you say, if you're a wealthy donor, you could only give, say, $2,600 directly to a candidate's campaign. But in the wake of Citizens United and SpeechNow, you could set up your own super PAC and say, invest $1 million in that super PAC, which then would go on to make independent expenditures on behalf of your candidate or against her opponent.
I feel like I heard about super PACs, though, Dante, before 2010.
Not as such. I mean, certainly it was the case. Like, if you go back to the 2008 campaign between Jean Shaheen and John Sununu, it wasn't as if, though there weren't outside groups participating in that particular election on one side or the other. But the super PAC itself, and the technical term would be an independent expenditure only group, those only rose up after the Citizens United decisions.
Again, our number for you to join us here on The Exchange, 1-800-892-6477. We're following the money in the 2014 elections here in New Hampshire, looking at the role of outside money in politics today, 1-800-892-6477. And Brian Walston, you've reported recently on another type of money besides PACs and super PACs, dark money. Now, what is that?
That's money by PACs or political committees that are nonprofits. the nonprofit politically active groups that under the regulations are actually regulated by the IRS and not by the Federal Elections Commission.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay,
so
go ahead.
So what they can do is basically shield their donors. They don't have to report their individual contributions to their organization. So they call it dark money because you don't really know the source of the money. I mean, certainly Americans for Prosperity, for example, is a very well-known group tied to the Koch brothers, the infamous Koch brothers. But you don't really know where their money's coming from. I mean, you can sort of align them with the industrial interests of the Koch brothers, but you don't really know where their money is coming from. The Chamber of Commerce, a big player in elections, also doesn't report their spending. There's been some players in this election, of course. The Americans for Prosperity spent a lot of money on the U.S. Senate race already. Ending Spending is another 501c4 group that doesn't report their donors. They're also a big player in that. On the Democratic side, you have the League of Conservation Voters, which has probably spent about $400,000 on ads attacking or supporting Senator Shaheen, but they also don't report their donors. So, you know, a consequence of Citizen United was these groups start shifting more of their money into these political nonprofits that don't have to report their donors.
Interesting, and that's where the dark comes from. So League of Conservation Voters, you can guess that their donors are conservation-minded folk, but you don't know if it's, you know, Susie Smith down the street or whatever.
Right, right.
Yeah, it's interesting, though, that they're nonprofits.
Well,
I mean, most people would say AFP, for example, is pretty profitable.
Well, if you look at it's a different type of nonprofit. You got 501c3s, which aren't allowed political activity. 501c4s are allowed up to a certain point. No one's quite determined what that point is. You know, I think the going rate right now, as long as you spend 49% of your activity on non-political or, you know, less than 50% on political activity, you're safe from the IRS enforcement. But, you know, I think a lot of groups, you know, they call themselves education groups, issue advocacy groups. And their point is that we're not campaigning or telling voters how to vote, who to vote for. We're educating them this so they can make a more informed choice about
I
who to
see.
Vote for.
Okay. So 501c3 is like the animal shelter or the food pantry or the Red Cross. 501c4 is a issue advocacy group, for example, on climate change or whatever issue you may pick. Well, Russ, I want to bring you into this as well. Now, you've been looking at this from both the Washington, D.C. level, but also, as I said, you've got some expertise here in New Hampshire. What's your take on how the sort of rules of the road have changed just in the last 4 or 5 years?
Well, I think that's a great question. And before you started off the first question to Dante by saying, you know, sort of back to basics. And I think Dante did a good job of trying to explain what's going on, but there is nothing basic anymore. There wasn't before much basic, but Citizens United has made things complicated, much more complicated. And it's created a lot of anxiety, and it's created a lot of disturbance. It's brought a lot more money into things. And I think that one of the effects it has, though, is that if you're a candidate and you're afraid that some group, a super PAC or a dark money group, is going to come out of nowhere and start spending money in your race, it gives you a lot of incentive to start fundraising a lot of money on your own and to build up your war chest. And I think that before there was we always had PACs and we had different kinds of groups. I think one of the things you may have been thinking of before, 527s was a kind of outside spending group that was very active in 2004, like the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth.
That's right. I remember that. Yeah. Go ahead.
So there were groups like that, but Swift Boat Veterans for Truth had to disclose their funders. And so there's a certain predictability about it, and there's a certain predictability about regular PACs. They can only raise so much from so many individuals, and they can only spend so much in a certain amount of time. And so you kind of knew what was coming. You might know that you were outgunned, but you knew that there was a PAC out there that was coming for you, and you could get a sense of how much money they had. With these groups, they can, you know, raise money instantly, basically. You know, the super PAC, someone can raise money. You know, someone with $1 million check can just give it to the super PAC. And today there's no super PAC. Tomorrow there's $1 million super PAC. And they can spend the money. They can call up the TV station and get ads, just, you know, blanket the next week with ads. And so you've got to really be prepared as a candidate. So I think that not only has it flooded a lot of outside money in, but it's also created sort of a new atmosphere for the campaigns themselves. And I think all of that has contributed to like a tremendous spike in the amount of money that's being spent.
Well, lots more to untangle, gentlemen, but let's invite our listeners again to join us. The number here in the exchange for you to join us with your questions and comments about money and politics, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And from Moultonboro, Michael's on the air. Hi, Michael, go ahead.
Hi. I was just wondering, since the Citizens United decision, there's almost been unlimited spending on ads and such. Shouldn't there be time limits, term limits to offset that unlimited money?
Did you say time limits or term limits, Michael?
Not term limits.
Yeah.
Term limits for congressmen.
And would that help stem the flow of money? Is that your idea, Michael?
No, I'm just, you know, you have the ability to spend so much to get somebody in and almost keep them in.
Yeah,
so
okay.
Why not limit their time in the Senate or in the House of Representatives?
Okay. Well, Michael, thank you for the call. That's a question for you, Dante. You're our political scientist. What about that, the idea that as an incumbent you have access to all this money and it's almost a guaranteed reelection?
Well, that's an interesting question. One thing to counter that is arguably Citizens United and the rise of super PACs have made the world a slightly more dangerous place for incumbents. And I say that because prior to Citizens United, when opponents of an incumbent had to go around and try to raise money in $500, $1,000, $2,000 increments, that takes a lot of work, and you need a big network of donors, which incumbents already have because they've already been elected once. But if you can rely on super PACs to come in and help you with just a few wealthy donors, then your road, if you're an opponent to an incumbent, your road to being a plausible contender is easier. And we've seen a lot of that happening in Republican primaries, where super PACs rise up and go after sitting incumbent Republican senators, for example. So in some ways, it's tilted things a little bit away from incumbents toward opponents, although incumbents certainly take advantage of this device of fundraising as well.
Well, Michael, it's a great question. And after a short break, we will take more of your questions and comments. This is The Exchange on NHPR, checking in now with our fall membership drive. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're following the money in New Hampshire's 2014 elections. And let's hear from you, your questions and comments about the PACs, super PACs, dark money, so forth that you've been hearing about in our races this year in the Granite State. Call in 1-800-892-6477. Send an email to exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. Again, you can call at 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Brian Walston, digital reporter for us here at NHPR. He's been covering campaign funding in New Hampshire's races. Dante Scala is also here, associate professor in the Department of Political Science at UNH. And Russ Choma, money and politics reporter for the Center for Responsive Politics. Russ also spent 5 years as a newspaper reporter here in the Granite State. And an email just came in, gentlemen, from Steve on Plum Island. And Russ, I'm going to throw it to you, I think. Steve says, the money behind the PACs. Yep, the Koch brothers have been mentioned, but there are many people with liberal persuasions that back super PACs, and their names should be aired as well. For instance, one might note that in Maine, the husband of Congresswoman Charlie Pingree is spending much money to back his points of view. Again, that's an email from Steve on Plum Island. Russ, both parties are playing this game, aren't they? There's a lot of attention to the Koch brothers, but there's a lot more participants in this game.
Absolutely. And I think that, the Koch brothers get a lot of attention, and they do spend a lot of money. They may spend more money than just about anyone else. But the emailer is correct. They're not the only people. They're not the only people on the conservative side, and there are a lot of liberal groups as well, and liberal individuals giving money. A big one is Tom Steyer, who's come to light. He's become very active in this cycle. He's actually backing a super PAC called Next Gen Climate Action Fund, which is actually the biggest spender in New Hampshire in terms of outside spending. Michael Bloomberg, who has been registered as a Republican and is run as a Republican, but has some very liberal beliefs, has given a ton of money for pro-gun control initiatives. And then I think that it's also worth noting that on the conservative side, it's not a monolith. The Koch brothers have some particular beliefs that they stand for, and they spend a lot of money, sort of a libertarian persuasion. But there are a lot of other people, and they are spending money against each other. They're spending money for their own candidates. There's a very strong establishment versus outside streak. So I think it's wrong to think that there's just one big bad evil person spending all the money.
Just following up on that. Just to make sure I heard you right, Russ. So you said Next Gen Climate, which is a liberal organization advocating for action against climate change. They're the biggest outside spender in New Hampshire right now?
I just pulled up the chart on our site, and our site has a profile for every race. And for New Hampshire, Next Gen Climate Action has spent $1.9 million in this cycle, including $520,000 in this past week. And that's the biggest outside spending group in the New Hampshire Senate race. Mayday PAC, which was Lawrence Lessig's group, is number two. And then Chamber of Commerce at $1.5 million, and they've spent $1 million in the last week, is number three. So, it's all over the map. It's definitely not one party. And I think New Hampshire's Senate race, is a great example of money, how money pours into a race and how it comes from sort of all directions.
Well, and that's reported spending, right, Brian Walston? There's other money out there that hasn't been reported yet,
Russ is absolutely right about about Next Gen and these groups. I mean, the groups that are supporting Senator Shaheen or are spending on their behalf are, they're just as active, if not more so, than on the Republican side. I mean, Americans for Prosperity, I think, has spent more. I mean, according to news reports, they've probably spent $2.6 million. But, of course, the point is that they don't report their spending to the Federal Election Commission. So it's really hard to tell.
That's right, because they're governed by the IRS,
right,
you said
exactly.
earlier.
I mean, what you have to do is you have to go and look at their FCC filing to see how much they spent on television commercials, which is something that it's a little bit labor-intensive. It's not so easy. But that's one way of tracking that type of spending.
Wow. So just to jump in, Brian, so you have to look at the Federal Election Commission for that type of money. You got to look at the IRS for these sort of nonprofit-ish groups, and then the Federal Communications Commission to see if they spend on advertising.
FCC started a few years ago. Television contracts, ad buys had to be posted in a public file on their stations. Now, I used to be able to go to the television station and look that up. But now if you want to know how much people are spending on television advertising, more and more stations are being required to post this information so you can go and check. But it's broadcast. It's not cable. So, and, of course, now there's, lots of spending on ads online, which also is a little bit difficult.
Yeah, so how do you track that? All right, well, Steve in Plum Island, thank you very much for that one. Here's a tweet from David. This is for you, Dante, I think. David says, have super PACs resulted in voters not going to the polls? Do they create adverse voting participation? David's a great question. Dante?
I don't think there's any evidence of that. I mean, certainly it's the case that you're seeing in this post-Citizens United environment more negativity. Okay, there's a good report out from the Wesleyan Media Project, which does analysis of political advertising, and they just issued a report saying that advertising is not only more numerous than it was at this same point 4 years ago, but it's also more negative. And the question then becomes, does negative advertising turn off people to politics?
Right.
And I think contrary to the conventional wisdom, evidence is not great that negative advertising actually discourages people from going to vote. I mean, it really depends a lot on what type of negative advertising it might be, and it really there's a broad range of negative advertising. So I don't think you can necessarily draw a clear red line from the fact that there's more of these groups out there, more involved, and lower voter turnout.
Well, David raises a point, though. I'm glad he did, because, Dante, I thought that political scientists said, or the conventional wisdom said, that part of the goal behind these ads is to depress turnout, is to make you feel so bad or at least uncertain about your candidate that you just don't bother.
I mean, there are efforts at doing that, to be sure, to try to suppress the vote or discourage people from going to vote. I'm just not sure that it's quite worked perhaps the way that they envisioned it would work. I don't know that voter turnout has gone down all that much. Of course, Citizens United has only been in place since 2010, so we've only got a couple of data points to look at. But I don't think it's necessarily the case that the negative advertising necessarily drives, you know, lower voter turnout. A lot more might depend on, say, whether there are competitive races. And, you know, if you look at the number of House races, for instance, that are truly competitive, and we have two competitive House races, two out of two, most states, I would think there's a minority of House races that are truly competitive. And if you don't have a competitive election, that's going to have more of an effect on voter turnout.
Okay, well, David, thanks for the tweet. And just a reminder, you're listening to The Exchange on NHPR during our fall fund drive. You can support these conversations by making a gift at nhpr.org. You can give us a call right now. Let's hear from you during our conversation about money and politics, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And all of you, just wanted to backstep a little bit into the whole philosophical thinking that undergirds this debate. And to you first, I think, Russ, this often boils down to whether people believe that money is speech or not. Tell us a little bit more about how the First Amendment keeps coming up, keeps playing out in all these discussions about campaign finance and all the groups participating today.
Well, I think that it's an interesting question, and I think that it's, you know, one that's gone back quite a few years. I think that it's gotten a lot of recognition lately, and I think especially in the 2012 election, a lot of talk about Citizens United and corporation are people, but I mean, that's a concept that's gone back for a while, and the idea that money is a way to express your free speech has gone back in a while, because if you want to support a candidate, you know, you could go to a rally, you could talk to your neighbors about them, you could put up a sign in front of your house, but really the most effective thing for the campaign is to give them a check, and so that they can hire buyers, they can hire pollsters, they can hire more professional sort of get out the vote operations. And so I think that's sort of been the idea behind it. And then the question became, who gets that right?
And who has more speech?
Right. And it becomes, there's the argument that, well, the market sort of lets you decide, doesn't it? You know, whoever is most popular will get more money. But that's also maybe arguably not true, because, the most popular thing is not always the right thing. And also, there's a lot of economic disparity. Some people just have a lot more money than other people. So it's definitely come up. And I think that there was another court decision this spring, which is also worth mentioning, called McCutcheon versus FEC. And that one was about whether or not we should remove the aggregate limits on how much an individual can give. You know, there's a limit. An individual can give $2,600 to a candidate for every election they're in. And each candidate has two elections. They've got a primary and a general, so $5,200. And then there was a limit that said we could only give about $40,000 to all candidates, and you could only give $122,000 total to everybody every 2 years, whether it's a candidate, whether it's a PAC, whether it's a party, no more than that. And this guy, Sean McCutcheon, went to the Supreme Court, and he said, well, that's not fair. I want to give $1,776 to as many different candidates as I want. And the Supreme Court sided with him. And so now it's been another big decision. We're still sort of waiting to see how it plays out. But most people aren't part of that conversation. We figure something like less than 0.2% of people give more than $2,600 ever. So most Americans don't give money. Most Americans, if they do give money, give very, 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 very small amounts of money. And they're not worried about being limited by this $122,000 limit. And I think that reignited a lot of this conversation about how much speech do you get, because Sean McCutcheon has the ability to give a lot more than most Americans do. And so that really sort of brought the conversation back.
Well, and Brian, I remember when people were really talking about this around 2010, you know, with Citizens United, but people have been talking about this for a long time. And some folks said, look, it's not the amounts that matter, it's disclosure. And so, you know, again, if Joe Jones has way more money than everybody else, at least we know where his donors are coming from. So talk about that idea of disclosure as the antidote to concern about large sums of money.
Well, it's not often noted, but, you know, one aspect of the Citizens United decision was the justices coming down on the side of disclosure, basically saying, you know, an antidote to this unrestricted spending would be disclosure. And I think there was an 8-1 vote on the court that's saying, you know, that would support disclosure regimes in states. And so lots of states have responded to this by trying to provide more transparency to the process and to the spending. And New Hampshire is no exception. They did this year. The legislature passed a bill. It was bipartisan support that would require 501c4s and nonprofits and groups that have not or are not required to report their spending to at least report their expenditures. Now, they're not – this. It's kind of weak in the sense that it doesn't require the groups to report their individual receipts, their individual donations, who gave them money. But at least if they were going to spend some money on an election, on advertising, mailers, whatever, they would have to report that to the Secretary of State's office, and people could go down there and get that record. So – you know, this goes back to there was a couple of groups, as Dante mentioned, nonprofits get involved in Republican primaries. A couple of groups got involved early in the Republican Senate here in the state. They have not, as far as I know, done a lot since the primary. I'm sure there's mailers and stuff going out, but these groups really are required to report the spending, and whether or not they're doing that is
the spending, but not the donations.
Right, right. And there's court decisions around the country challenging this. Every time there's a disclosure regimen that comes up, it's being challenged, and the courts so far have upheld most of these. But there's decisions that go the other way as well, so it remains to be seen what will happen with the New Hampshire legislation.
All right. Well, in a moment, we'll talk a little bit more about that and some of the money that is playing a role in some of New Hampshire's races. We've talked about the U.S. Senate. We can talk about the congressional races as well. Dante Scala, I know you have to go. Thank you very much for giving us your time this morning.
Oh, you're very welcome.
That's Dante Scala, Associate Professor in the Department of Political Science at UNH. More questions, comments, and thoughts from you after a short break. We're going to check in now with our fall membership drive. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, next in our series of Rudman Center Conversations with the Candidates, we'll broadcast our interview tonight with Governor Maggie Hassan, and you can listen in tomorrow morning at 9. Right now, we're talking about money in politics in the 2014 elections here in the Granite State. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Russ Choma is with us from D.C. He's money in politics reporter for the Center for Responsive Politics, and Brian Walston, digital reporter for NHPR, who's been covering campaign funding in New Hampshire races. And gentlemen, before we go back to our listeners, Russ, you did write about New Hampshire's U.S. Senate race. You talked about the large amounts of outside money. You said, I think I'm quoting you right, that's a lot of scratch for a small state. But here's the question for you, Russ. We are a small state. Is it reasonable to expect most of the money funding our races would come from inside? You know, there's just not that many people here.
Well, you know, I think New Hampshire is obviously a special case because it has a special role in the presidential election. And I think every time you look at how much attention people outside of New Hampshire give to it, you have to factor that in. You know, people are always vying for a better position and to establish a ground game and to make contacts. So I think that definitely has some of it. And I think, you know, people would just pay more attention to New Hampshire than elsewhere. When we look at a list of the top races with outside spending, Iowa Senate and New Hampshire Senate are in the top 10, and they're surrounded by states like Kentucky and North Carolina, which are big states, which have, you know, very, very prominent races and politicians. So, you know, I think some of it is just New Hampshire earns a special place. But at the same time, you know, if you look at, I was just, during the break, I was looking at what the cheapest Senate race in 2010 was. The candidate who spent the least amount of money, it was Angus King from Maine. An independent, right. And there, I mean, and that race was a very unusual race, and there were some very funny things going on there. But the average winning House or Senate race in 2012, I think, cost about $11 million. The average winning candidate spent $11 million. And I think he spent around $3 million. And so there were a lot of dynamics there, but it, I mean, it shows that not every big state has big spending, or every small state has big spending, or expects money from outside. And I think the other thing that I wrote about was the campaigns themselves. Where do they get, you know, what percentage of the money is coming from out of state? And we're not talking about outside groups; we're talking about the campaigns. And I think Gene Shaheen's campaign has about 72% of the individual donors is from out of state. I think Scott Brown's is about 80%. And I think that is those numbers are out of whack with what the norm is. Most, I mean, those are very, very high numbers for both candidates.
Okay, so we've been talking a lot this hour about big money, and here you are raising the idea of small money in that main race, Russ. There was an attempt, Brian Walston, in 2012 in Massachusetts to keep it small, also between Scott Brown and Elizabeth Warren. What happened there?
Well, it worked. You know, Senator Brown was running for re-election, and Elizabeth Warren was his opponent, and he proposed actually that they take a people's pledge to limit the amount of outside money that comes in. You know, and Elizabeth Warren said sure. So I think there was, if I can remember correctly, it's about 9% of the money spent was from outside, and it was about $8 million. Now, if you looked at something like the Virginia Senate race, it was like 60% of the money spent was from outside. So there was a large drop. I mean, this pledge worked. It kept dark money limited, and it kept a lot of television ads off the air. So this year, Senator Shaheen proposed it to Senator Brown, and he or
a people's
and
pledge.
Yeah, and he decided that he wasn't going to take her up on it. Now, you could argue that in 2012, neither Brown nor Warren needed it, and I think they spent close to $80 million between the two of them.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
So, I mean, they have plenty of money. This year, Brown was in a different position. He was lagging in fundraising, certainly, to the incumbent. But he couldn't be sure that he was going to be able to raise enough money that he needed. So, I mean, he probably needs that outside spending this year.
And just to super clarify, Russ, Maine, for example, has certain campaign finance laws on the books, but those can only apply to state races, right, Russ? I mean, federal races are governed by federal campaign finance laws.
Right, right.
Okay.
And states have to abide by whatever the federal government sets, but federal candidates don't have to abide by the state.
Okay. Let's take another call if we could. Again, the number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Again, I want to remind you, you're listening to The Exchange on NHPR during our fall fund drive. You can support these conversations by making a gift, nhpr.org. And let's go to Tina waiting in Dublin. Hi, Tina. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I had a two-part question. The first part being, with all the poverty that we have in America and our congressmen and women
Tina, you're fading out there. Go ahead, please.
With all the poverty that we have in America, how can we justify the spending that's going into all these campaigning?
And then you said had another question. Yeah, go ahead.
Yep, the second question being, what happens to the money that's not spent, that's put into campaigning?
Afterwards, when it's all over, what happens to the leftovers? Because I'm guessing sometimes there are leftovers. Russ, I don't know if you want to address, you know, how can we spend all this money on campaigning when we do have so much need in this country? You can address that if you want. But the other question, too, I'm guessing you can address. What happens to the money if I run for office and I've got a couple million left over?
Sure. Well, so I can't really say whether, you know, we don't take a position on the rightness or wrongness of the spending of the money. But the last election, the 2012 election, cost $6.2 billion. And that's the money that we know about. That doesn't count probably a couple hundred million dollars in dark money. And it doesn't count the money that was spent on state races or local races. $6.2 billion is a lot of money. And, you know, we haven't developed an estimate for how much is going to get spent this year, but it's going to be more than it was in 2010, the last congressional year. And so, I mean, probably north of $3.5 billion just on the congressional races. So there's a lot of money. The second question, what happens to the money at the end? There's sort of the thought is that a well-run race doesn't leave money on the table. You know, if you've got the money, you're going to spend it. That said, you know, sometimes you don't have much of an opponent, or sometimes it's not a well-run race, and there is money left over. One of the situations where you see money left over a lot of the time is when someone gets beat in the primary. So, you know, they've built up a big war chest, and they're saving part of it, expecting to spend it in the general election, and they get beat in the primary.
I see. So they've got something left over from the primary, and they don't win the primary, so what do they do with all the cash?
Right. And then the other one is someone who's been a very successful candidate or incumbent for a long time who suddenly decides that they're not going to run anymore. And I've actually written about this a couple of times. The most prominent example, the person who has the most money left over, is Marty Meehan of Massachusetts. He's now a chancellor in the UMass system, and he has about $6.5 million just sitting in a bank account. And the rules are that you can spend it on pretty much anything you want. It can't be spent on you personally. But
so you can't
can
go on donate, a nice trip or something.
Right, right. But you can donate it to charity, and you can give it to, which actually does happen, and you can also give it back to the people who gave it to you, which also does happen, although not that often, but it does happen. And then you can continue to use it for anything that you would have used it before. So, you know, if you are thinking about running again, you can save that money and use it for a future race. You can give it to other candidates. I think Marty Meehan was thinking about running again at some point, so he was keeping it. But he does give money away every year to charity, and he also gives money away to other candidates, other Democrats. And then also, you know, you can just let it sit there if you want. You don't have to do anything. It doesn't do a lot for you, but the money can just sort of hang around. And we've seen increasing numbers. This is one of the reasons that we wrote the stories. We've seen increasing numbers of candidates leaving office with large amounts of money. And I think it has something to do with long-term incumbents are retiring.
Well, Tina, it's a good question. Thank you very much. And last question for you, Brian. We talked a little bit earlier about the dark money that you've been covering. Again, these are the 501c4s, which are a different type of nonprofit, but still considered a nonprofit, so they don't have to disclose their donors. But you also said the Citizens United decision emphasized disclosure and the importance of knowing at least who is giving. Why don't these 501c4 dark money donors want to be disclosed? If they really like Joe Jones, the candidate, why not say to the world, I like Joe Jones?
Well, I think a lot of it comes, I mean, certainly the argument on the side of people who would argue against disclosure, that this kind of spending ought to be allowed to be private, if this is that the people will face some sort of retribution. Their community, their employer might find out that they're contributing to candidates or causes that are unpopular with their peers or whatever, and they feel like they'll be punished for it. I mean, certainly we've seen cases that appeared to be that. The Mozilla chairman, there was a lot of, in the anti-gay marriage proposition in California, there was some worry that, you know, Hollywood stars who contributed to against it would suffer for it. You know, I mean, this goes back. I mean, they're using an argument that goes back to the 50s with the NAACP. I think there was a case in the federal courts that said, well, you know, if you're going to face, you know, physical harm for it, then you can be protected from disclosure in that regard. But, you know, I think it's people are sort of extending that argument out to now to say that, you know, you could suffer in your community or
your
in
business.
Your business.
Yeah. Well, gentlemen, I think we're going to have to revisit this issue again because there's a lot more to untangle. And as the campaign continues, there'll be even more to look at. Brian Walston, thank you very much for giving us your time.
Thank you, Laura.
Brian Walston, digital reporter for NHPR. You can look at his coverage of money and politics at our website, nhpr.org. Russ Chalmo, it's great to have you. Talk to you again.
Thank you for having me.
That's Russ Chalmo, money and politics reporter for the Center for Responsive Politics. He used to be a newspaper reporter here in the Granite State. This is The Exchange on NHPR. We're checking in very quickly now with our fall membership drive.